2023 will be looked back on as the year when AI reached a tipping point in public consciousness. After the initial shock of using ChatGPT and other platforms, more of us are asking questions, not just about the moral concerns of the technology, but how it will affect every aspect of our lives, from education, politics, healthcare, to how capitalism will evolve. At The Evolving Leader, we'll be gaining a range of perspectives on this most disruptive of leadership topics. In this show, we're talking to the founder of an AI scale-up who's trying to balance this disruptive power with moral responsibilities for the outcomes it can create. We all need to engage in this conversation because it will define our futures.
Hi friends, welcome to the Evolving Leader Podcast, the show born from the belief that we need deeper, better, more aware, inclusive, collaborative, and deeply accountable leadership to confront the world's biggest challenges. I'm Scott Allender, co-host of the show, along with John Gomes, and today we are also joined by occasional co-host and always friend, the brilliant Emma Sinclair. Emma, let's start with you today in our feelings check-in. How are you feeling today, Emma?
I'm feeling excited and very honored to join you with our guest today, and very much looking forward to speaking with our guest. So feeling excited and ready.
John, how are you feeling?
Oh, I'm always, this is always like one of the high points of the week for me. So I'm feeling great. I'm feeling rested and recovered after our kind of long weekend over Easter. So I'm really, really set to engage. How are you feeling, Scott?
I'm feeling overstimulated. I've had lots of coffee and I've just come through a bunch of meetings. And so, I'm buzzing, but I feel alive and I'm feeling really excited to jump into our conversation today. And today we are joined by Alex Zakoff. Alex is the CEO and co-founder of an organization called Thoughtful. Thoughtful's mission is to accelerate the world's adoption of automation and AI so humans can solve our most complex existential problems. They don't believe humans were meant to endlessly move pieces of data around. Computers were. Automation gives human workers the freedom to pursue the creative, strategic work that builds companies, as well as their careers. So Thoughtful's robotic process automation aims to help businesses save up to 90% of their workforce's time, increasing operational efficiency and lowering expenses. Alex, welcome to the Evolving Leader Podcast.
Hey, Scott, Emma, John, nice to meet you all. Excited to be here.
Alex, welcome to the show. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling great. I actually just got back from my wedding and honeymoon. So,
Congratulations.
3 years of building this company, and I didn't really take off. So it was my first vacation in like 3 years. So I'm energized, ready to go, ready to chat, and excited to get to connect with you today.
So Alex, together with your friend Dan Parsons, you built Thoughtful. Can you tell us briefly about your background and why you created this venture?
Yeah, absolutely, John. The origin story is, you know, I always like to look back at my life and it all makes sense. And it's not until you can observe all the pieces that you're like, oh, this is how we got here. So I started my career back in 2009, Deloitte Consulting's technology group, building large SAP systems for aerospace and defense companies. I did that for primarily before I went to business school. I actually moved to Japan for a couple of years, helped Mitsubishi set up a company called Mitsubishi Aircraft Corporation. From there, I was sponsored to go back to business school. I went to Berkeley for 2 years, focusing in entrepreneurship, design thinking, venture capital, basically just getting in Silicon Valley and learning the ropes. From there, I was sponsored, so I had the golden handcuffs. I had to go back to Deloitte. And I was really fortunate at the time, because I was really in this mindset of looking for a big problem space, big market, big sort of hidden market, hidden opportunity, always entrepreneurs are looking for. It's something non-obvious. Went back into RPA, robotic process automation. We'll talk about that today, what that means. Essentially, software robots. I was deploying it actually at my first client, aerospace and defense client. We had built the ERP system 10 years prior. I come back post-business school. We're building robots to operate the software. In my mind, it clicked. We're going to look back. Maybe in 20 years, we're going to look back and go, wow, I can't believe humans touch the keyboards and we move data. It's going to seem like Henry Ford's assembly line in 1913 when people were creating the cars on the assembly line. You fast forward the 1980s, there's robots in factories now, and that took 70 years, and it happened 10 years in the digital world. So if you market size the entire world of human labor that operates software, like just us, you know, clicking keyboards and moving data, that's $7 trillion of labor each year that moves data on systems. So if you think about that as like the market, and essentially with robotic process automation, AI, all of these tools, you can essentially collapse that to about 10%. You only need 10% of human labor to operate the same amount of work. It's a massive market. And how it was being done with the current players, I didn't like. It was messy. It was expensive. Like true things, it was the average robot we were deploying was costing $400,000 to $500,000. And it was only providing about one human FTE of value. So 4 to 5 years of payback. That seemed in today's technology world a little slow. So with that, my good friend Dan had moved to San Francisco. I was tired of working for, you know, the big organization. I was ready to jump ship, left Deloitte 2019. At the time, I bought thoughtfulautomation.com for $12. And that was our original name. I said, Dan, I raised $40,000 in a day from Dan and a couple other friends and my dad. And just said, I need to go into this. I didn't even have a pitch deck. I just like, there's something here. And from there, we iterated in the first year. We raised $1 million the first year, raised $7 million the second year, and we raised another $13 million last year. So we've sort of just in the last, the last 2 years, it's been a crazy fundraising environment. So we've just been grabbing the bag, as they say, and then really investing in our platform. So that's where we're at today. Really excited. We've got really focused in healthcare right now, real estate, legal, but primarily healthcare cost savings. And really excited to share about all of that and all the work we've been working on and doing.
So can you give our listeners just a bit of clarity about what you sell, what are these products that you are building?
Yeah, the best way to describe them is to use a physical world corollary. So there's physical robots, and physical robots have sensors to do the work. So robots, they have eyes, you know, they have some sort of cognition, usually some sort of machine learning. These software robots act the same way as physical robots, and think of the different AI tools as sensors. So RPA is kind of like the skeleton. It's what creates the robot. The robot does the task across, you know, repetitive workflows. Optical character recognition or OCR, like the eyes. Natural language processing is like the ears for the robots. And then large language models like ChatGPT or the brain. And so why it's been very exciting in this world is before we really haven't had true cognition, these robots have been quite dumb. Per se, you have to still tell them what to do. Now with large language models, they can actually start to make decisions that humans are making, which is awesome and exciting, but also, as I think we'll talk about later, a little scary of the impact on that. And so what we do is we basically containerize all those technologies in our smart robot technology and think of our platform as the Gigafactory. If we use Elon Musk's Tesla factory, our robots create the robots. So we actually have a lot of infrastructure to build these robots automatically. So it takes about 30% of the effort to build a robot in security, infrastructure, and tooling. We do that automatically with our own bots. So our bots are creating bots that are operating software. So we're kind of third order deep into this like automation paradigm. And so we're actually able to produce robots at scale. So what that means is when I was at Deloitte doing this, it would take 6 months to produce a robot that would basically replicate one human FTE of labor value. We can produce a robot now in 4 to 6 weeks. And we're getting quicker. So we can basically, I could watch John or Scott or Emma, I could watch your workflow for a day. Let's say you had a repetitive workflow. You're processing healthcare claims in America. And that's all you did. It took 30 minutes to get your workflow. We watch that, we design it, and we can replicate that in 4 to 6 weeks. We license that back to the company as sort of digital labor. And they pay a SaaS model. So they pay sort of just this monthly, and we maintain it. So bot goes down, breaks, we keep it up and running. So we're sort of like the health insurance for the bot.
So let's talk about the scary a little bit, because I'm one of those people that get both excited and a bit nervous at some of this technology. So the sort of AI services, you know, things like GPT and these robots that have cognition that you're talking about. Can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, for our listeners who may be, you know, a little unclear about, you know, what all this means and where it's all heading. And you started to talk about that a bit, but, you know, when you think about the future of organizations, you think about the future of job security and some of these things you're talking about, like healthcare claim processing, can you give us a little more color about, you know, how, you know, should we be frightened or should we be more excited and why?
I will take the optimistic point of view on this. I think this is incredibly exciting. I think like all new technologies, we're like living in a moment and we, you know, telephone operators back in the day were probably scared when, you know, automatic switchboarding came in, but then those people were freed up to work on more creative things. Mm-hmm. I think the data point I'm focusing on here is that there's not demand for a lot of this work anymore. So there's actually a lot of mental health issues around repetitive work. People don't like to show up to work every day and just go through a repetitive workflow and not have any creativity in their job. And a lot of software work has become that. It's, hey, here's your standard operating procedure. You get an input, you need to work through a workflow. Maybe some cognition along the way, but very light. And then you just need to get outputs faster and faster. So having humans compete with robots is a losing game in my mind. And I think if we think about robots as our assistants, if we think about them as helpers, and instead of just having to do all the work, we can just focus on the creative work, which is really exciting. I think that basically just means we just 10x our productivity in the world, which is awesome. And I think in environments like this where we have high interest rates and we need to look to more productivity, this is actually a solution to that. It's a deflationary by nature technology. So this AI is a solution for that. Where it gets scary is when we start to replace the big decisions, right? So like processing a healthcare claim, for example, let's say a healthcare claim gets denied and there's, you know, 10 different reasons why and a human's helping make that decision. I think that's okay for AI to make that decision instead of a human, as long as it's within, you know, 99.9% accuracy and it's confident it's making the right decision. We're actually just helping healthcare providers get paid faster in the United States, which is a good thing. Now let's look at like a very extreme use case. AI is making decisions on war, like who dies and who lives. That's bad. Like, I don't think putting pure logic behind that is a really good thing for an AI to solve, because an AI is not going to have, you know, the contextual data we use in our brains. We don't even know like 95% plus of our brains yet. So I almost think of this as like, the scary part is it's like the blind leading the blind right now. We're developing these models, but we don't even have pure, you know, brain. We don't even know most of our brain. So we're developing brains for these things that are maybe elementary in nature, and we're still have elementary brains in the grand scheme of things. So I think we have to be very careful. I do think regulation oversight will be needed in how we have applied AI use cases in different verticals. So saving costs, yes. Making decisions that impact lives, human in the loop. Let's put a human in the loop to make sure there's like actually some governing board making that decision before it's just automated fully. But back to my original stance, overall, I think this is a net positive for society.
So as we think about how companies like Thoughtful and other organizations who are providing these kind of services might start to mature, if we fast forward 5 years into the future and think about what organizations might be doing when they have this as a kind of a common kind of platform on which to base their businesses, it's not just going to be about efficiency gains and eliminating people out of drudgery work. It's going to fundamentally change the nature of work and what organizations can do. Have you got a kind of a sense of what the world's going to look like when that happens?
I think the paradigm of starving artists will change, and it'll be the rich artists. I think creativity will be whatever's the hardest thing to replicate will be more valued in society. So interpersonal dynamics, relationships, us talking here, right? This will be valuable, right? Creating interesting dialogue that is human, that humans still crave human dialogue. They can even tell now that it's a GPT-generated text versus a human-generated text. And I think humans will still desire to have error, imperfection in things. So, and I think artistry will evolve and artists will get paid more to have unique, again, scarcity gets paid. So if you're an artist putting a scarce product in the world, those artists get paid. And so I think it will change fundamentally how we think about careers. I think the idea of going to get a four-year degree in accounting, which is primarily rules-based and can be automated, that will likely, and I hate this for the accounting industry, but like over time go away, and there'll be need to be more, you know, less people, but making creative decisions around accounting, creating new accounting structures, you know, more blockchain, like that sort of thinking will be valued, but just following rules, I think of the legal industry as one is like, it's primarily past oriented, looking at rules and basically upholding the law. That can be very much programmed. And so I think that industries where it's defined on rule sets will have to evolve, but the creatives will win in this market. The influencers, the people putting out content faster, and it's more creative. It just means you need less people to make the content. As we're seeing with generative AI, you can generate images now almost instantly. We actually even produce blog content now. We were producing, before all these large language models came out, we were producing about 10 blog posts a month. Last month, I think we put out about 80 blog posts with the help of AI assistants. So there's just going to be more stuff in the world. It's kind of like your Netflix content queue. You're just like, wow, where's all this content coming from? But again, I think people that can break through the noise and still produce the best content, think of like, who are the HBOs of the world? Who are putting out the best shows? And it's original and it's human in nature. I think that's, those people get paid in the future. But it will fundamentally shift how we think about education. I'm very interested to see, I've already seen articles of students getting in trouble for using ChatGPT to write their essays. I kind of think that's like past looking. I actually think the students that are learning how to become prompt engineers are going to be paid the most. How do you prompt the AI model and get it to give the best output? Those are the students, actually, probably the ones that are getting in trouble now are going to get paid the most in the future. So I'm kind of laughing at these students who are getting in trouble, because they're probably going to be the ones like making the most money in the future using the AI to their benefit.
It's kind of similar to hackers. A few years ago, that hacker logic then suddenly becomes really valuable.
Yes, absolutely.
And you talked about healthcare claims and how you could see that in terms of automation. And I wonder, given the breadth of Thoughtful and what you work on, whether you see a certain amount of workflow in different industries that are just way behind the curve. Like, if you took an industry and went, that is ready, where, you know, what's your view on leaders and laggards maybe in this space?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've actually started to dip our toes in other industries. We're primarily focused in healthcare revenue cycle management now, because we find it's the biggest market opportunity. But as we think about building franchises and, like you said, maybe laggard industries in tech that need more digital evolution, manufacturing is one. A lot of that, you know, supply chain is still email-based. A lot of that, you know, third-party logistics stuff is, hey, you get an email from someone, you got to scan a document, you got to put in a system. That's still very manual, and there's a lot of technology innovation that needs to happen in those industries. Insurance, on the other side of the healthcare, insurance, a lot of back office, paper pushing. Financial services, a lot of back office, paper pushing. Government, U.S. government back office. I worked with the government contractor, so I know how much bureaucracy and paperwork it is, and people just pushing paper. Legal, paralegal, that's a huge one. Real estate, property management, a lot of manual processes, a lot of scanning documents. So there's a lot of industries that are not tech first that are going to get revolutionized by being AI first, and it's just getting started. So I think as we think about building franchises outside of healthcare, the ones that are excited the most are real estate, for sure, manufacturing, insurance, financial services back office. And government. Those are sort of the other ones we're eyeing right now as ripe for innovation.
Hmm. So you recently wrote that balancing the interests of your team with realities of the market and organizational goals is getting increasingly challenging, and that to avoid a sinking ship, leaders need to approach management by cutting through the noise and focusing on what you call first principles, which are defined as a basic proposition or assumption that cannot be deduced from any other proposition or assumption. So what are these first principles and how do we get there?
Yeah, so in the problem-solution kind of paradigm, we always look for problems and then solutions to solve problems. The third piece of that is cause. Problem, what's the cause of the problem? Solution. So I think of first principles as the root cause. So you might look at something and go, oh, there's a problem. For example, sales are slowing. So the natural maybe thought is, oh, it must be our sales reps, right? That must be the problem. When actually, and we've actually even discovered this too, it's not your sales reps. The cause is actually you have poor messaging on the website, or you don't have a unique selling proposition. And so it's not the sales reps are doing a poor job. it's you as a company has poor messaging to the market, and there's not message market fit. So that's the first principle, and go solve the messaging, and then the sales reps become crazy efficient, hitting quota, all of that. And so if you apply that to anywhere in your business, I think it's a natural intuition that we want to just say the problem is the thing in front of us versus what is the actual cause of that, instead of blaming the person is the underlying thing. An example, it could be product market fit, message market fit, personnel issues, that. But what is the actual core problem versus the apparent problem? Mm-hmm.
So we see kind of this in action all the time, that management teams are talking about symptoms, they are talking about second, third order consequences of decisions and root cause. How do you get there? How do you help people to think like that? What's your process?
Civilized debate. In a world where people like to, I think a media exacerbates this issue, attack for having different ideas, you want to create a culture of welcoming ideas, pushing back on ideas. As CEO, I have to be very careful of this, because when I walk into a room, my idea can be weighted more. And so understanding, I like to say after I open up a new idea, I say, feel free to debate me. I open it up. I want people to challenge my idea, because I don't want to be the most correct person in the room. I want someone to beat my idea, but at least I'll go first and put an idea out there in the market. And so I think creating a culture at an organization where it's okay to say, I disagree with that idea and here's why, steel manning a point of view, is really helpful. So John, you said something and I disagree with it fundamentally, but I'm going to steel man. I'm going to actually come to your side and actually cognitively think like why you're right before I go talk about my point of view. That at least helps us get to a connection and we can sync and I can actually see that. And then we can have a nice debate about what's the truth, which is likely between your idea and my idea. It's in the middle. I find that most ideas, most solutions are in the middle, and we want to welcome discussions around it. A lot of cultures that are very hierarchical in nature, maybe a little more top down, it's usually like the most senior person in the room wins, and then you don't get all the innovation from everyone at the company. So creating a flat structure where it doesn't matter if you're the CEO, director, or an individual contributor, you want the best idea to win. An idea meritocracy is the first priority of any organization.
And in that kind of conversation, that free-flowing conversation where people feel safe to be able to challenge things, there's also the idea of being able to bust assumptions that people are holding about their ideas and about what's possible and feasible and so on. How do you do that in a way that the kind of, not just the emotional part of it, but the rational part of it? How do you help people to break through those assumptions that are holding them back?
Great question. I think the best way to get people to stand behind their ideas is to put data behind it. So a lot of times these conversations happen like we're having, and it's just ideas, but then doing the work to go put an actual deck together and get some data and do some research and test a hypothesis and put an experiment together and A/B test it to actually say, I don't know, but I'm going to go test this. And here are my two hypotheses, my A/B test, and we're going to run this experiment for 2 to 4 weeks and we're going to see what happens. And then we're going to present. That's actually the best way, is just, I'm going to run an experiment and I'm going to show you with data that this is the way. That's the most convincing argument. Now, sometimes there's not always time to run experiments, but at our organization, we always try to, if we are in sort of an impasse and we can't make a decision, we run an experiment and then we move forward. Or a likely tool we use is disagree and commit. This was made famous by Jeff Bezos. For example, my co-founder and I, we know sometimes we can't just spend 4 weeks making decisions. So if someone's more passionate about it and they clearly have an intuition that the other person doesn't, we just say disagree and commit. I will likely put my disagree out, but I'm committing to my co-founder, Dan, that I'm with you and I'm not going to make you wrong if this doesn't work out. Like, we're just going to go down a path, and speed wins in markets, especially in AI markets. So speed is actually the first priority. Data experimentation, second, and that's sort of the hierarchy, I think, at least that my co-founder and I use as we're thinking about our decision-making matrix.
Yeah, it's really interesting because in the piece that you wrote about this, that where you first came to our attention, you described how smart people can lie to themselves because they use their intelligence to make convincing arguments that undermine ultimately their long-term interests. And one of the things that you mentioned in this testing was creating a blue and a red team to disrupt that kind of thinking. Can you talk to us a little bit about that process?
Best use case for that we have at the organization is for hiring. What I've seen when people want to hire someone, there's a lot of biases when they're making that decision, whether it be a personal desire to have, you know, this person from an Ivy League school come, which is a bias, and a pedigree bias, or all these things that can show up. And I think it's really important as a hiring committee, especially when you're making your first 100 hires, you want everyone to be culturally aligned, mindset aligned, high skill, high will, culture fit. So for us, we typically use this as a committee and we assign one person as the red team player. So regardless if they like the person or not, or recommending them to hire, that person's job is to red team and say why they shouldn't be at the company. It at least puts that data in the room. So we're not just rosy-eyed colored glasses and we're just like looking at the positives. We need to look at both sides to make sure we're making the best hire. One of the most expensive mistakes is obviously a bad hire. In an organization that can take 6 to 9 months, affect culture. And that's, really important to get right early on, because every the first 100 create the culture, the first 100 are going to hire the next 10. That's how you get to 1,000. So if you get any bad areas of your org in the first 100, it's just going to multiply once you scale the company past 100. So that's a good use of a red team, blue team in a hiring committee situation.
Hi, folks. Phil Kirby here, producer of the show. If you're enjoying The Evolving Leader and would like to stay connected with us between episodes, follow us on Twitter at evolving_leader. And please be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We really appreciate your support. Thanks for listening.
I would be really interested to, like, fast forward, as John was saying, sort of 5 years' time. And we've brought our lagging industries forward in automation, and we've got more stuff, which was the phrase that you used. We've got more stuff. We've got more valuable stuff, but we've still got humans with a finite amount of potential skill. Appreciate, our brains are still being discovered, but what in your mind are humans doing in that space, and what can you unlock in that space?
Yeah, I think that's a really great thought exercise. Like, what do we actually do once we automate everything? Is it, there's been arguments for universal basic income and it's all just distributed. There's been arguments for, I think, a lot of different ways it could look. I think it's probably us getting back more into the physical world, to be honest. I think we have a lot of physical world problems that we've, in the last 20, 30 years, the internet came out and we're all like, great, this is awesome. We just want to play on computers all day. But we actually need to fix bridges, and we've got decaying infrastructure, and we need food, and so maybe I'm just going to put it out there. Maybe like farming becomes a thing again, right? Really, like people are like, I'm going to go farm. I'm going to produce calories, and that's likely what we need as humans. And I'm going to go and become a mechanic, and trade is actually going to be, something we really invest in here in America, at least. Versus a four-year degree. So I generally think there's going to be more of a moving back to trade mentorship, less like needing the master's and PhD and all of that signaling. So I think that's a good thing. I think that's it's going to help solve problems. I also think there's going to be more creativity. So I think influencers, I think the young generation, knows how to work tech really well, and they're going to, marketing channels are going to keep primarily be dominated through influencers and not just ads. So I think that's going to be a new, like, official career path is being an influencer. What else do we do? I think it's going to be really interesting. We're going to have to work less, which is interesting. So the 40-hour work week might become 20. So what do we do in all that spare time? That's a really great question. I don't think we've really solved fundamentally, like, when we're bored as humans, like, what do we fill that space with?
Yeah. In fact, so much of this sounds a bit boring to me, if I'm honest. like as much as I can appreciate as I, you know, I can appreciate what you're saying about the health, mental health issues that could come with repetitive, you know, redundant work that doesn't feel very purposeful. The sort of increasing automation that leaves people feeling so bored and, you know, lonely, and loneliness is becoming kind of an epidemic of, you know, giant proportions. Absolutely. In this world. And it feels like, you know, if we keep automating everything, which I know we can't really stop it, nor am I saying we should, but it feels like there's broader ethical considerations and concerns. And even some of the stuff we're talking about here can feel a bit privileged too, because, you know, if I'm, you know, in a lower income area, I know you're saying maybe degrees go away, but I have kind of a trade that's now being automated. I don't live near a farm, so I'm not going to go start farming. Like, what am I doing with my life? I'd love to hear some of your reactions to that, but also even on a broader context, what are the ethical considerations that we must confront in all of this?
I think that is where we need to, as a society, like, maybe slow down a little bit, because Elon actually put this out, I think, in front of a bunch of leaders. Like, maybe let's slow down the whole GPT. Let's not get to GPT-6 yet. Like, we don't even know what GPT-4's implications are. Hmm. We do need to have some sort of responsible AI committee in the world to think about the human psychology factor of this. I think generally capitalism is this, it's more. It's, we want more and more and more, faster, faster, faster. But that's all incentivized by profits and margin and dollars. I think in a new economy like this, we might fundamentally need to shift. Like, maybe capitalism isn't the maybe it's not the economic model in an AI world. Like, maybe profit isn't good in AI, because then it's just like, it's not just the 1%, it's the top 100th percentile of a percent that get all the money. What does everyone else do who doesn't know AI? Because there's only going to be so many people that know how to build the models, deploy robots. Right. I feel very blessed that somehow I'm in this. But now I feel this, like, what is going to happen to everyone else? One way we are actually solving this, and thoughtful as part of our brand consciously, is that our platform is human loop first. So we don't actually automate out people 100%. We actually build it so a person logs in who's an entry-level worker and gets to learn how to operate the robot, and then they reinforce the robot's data. So it's actually a reinforcement platform. So it actually will probably just change that the person, instead of doing the work, has to manage the robots now. And then that becomes their new job, is like they're a bot manager versus like a work doer. And so that's been our human loop first principles design. It's like, we want to keep people in the loop. Some companies don't take that stance, but we actually think it's more powerful when you combine human cognition with the robots. You just get like way more leverage. That being said, I also very much know that you don't need 10 bot managers. If you had 10 people there before, you probably only need one or two bot managers. So what do those 8 people do? It's reskilling. I think one of the most like hidden markets out there that will probably be the first multi-trillion-dollar company is if you could at scale reskill people. Like you said, the person in the lower socioeconomic group who doesn't know what to do, can you reskill them and put them in an AI economy? Somehow plugging in of, there's all these things, training data, bot management. And maybe you need to go get like a 3-month degree and learn how to, you know, write some Python code. And you know, the coding languages now are becoming so user-friendly that actually learning Python can take 3 months. That's what we build our bots in, Python. And so maybe you go learn Python, you can start helping fix the bots, like a bot mechanic. Like, we actually have a marketplace of, we employ 30 full-time Python engineers on our marketplace around the world. Ukraine was actually our first country where we found amazing talent and Python engineers, and we're in Eastern Europe, Latin America, Vietnam. There's amazing Python talent across the world, and so we're actually helping give those jobs to Python engineers. So if you know Python, you can make money building bots for us. So that's sort of a way to make money. So there's all these creative ways. It's just, we need entrepreneurs to come solve those problems and create new jobs. They just haven't been defined yet. And so if we go too fast, to your point, Scott, if we go way too fast, we're not going to have time for the entrepreneurs to catch up and build the companies with the jobs for the labor. So we do need to, at some point, likely slow down a little bit. It does feel fast right now.
So what this is kind of blowing my mind, actually, thinking about the the consequences of this, but when I think about, you know, this message that has been out there for, you know, some years about the fourth industrial revolution, hasn't felt it. Yes, there is amazing things happen, but it hasn't felt as disruptive as this. This feels like it's in a completely different league because, as you said, there, you know, this calls into question the very nature of capitalism and the value exchanges and the production lines across the world and supply chains and everything that you can think of. It really sort of upends a lot of the current assumptions. And we're already going through, you know, decoupling of globalization at the moment because of what's happening with geopolitics. I was really intrigued, and I wanted to know what you meant by this, but in Forbes, you made some predictions about this year, and one of them was goodbye wokeism. Being woke is out in 23. People want to address real-world problems pertaining to war, food production. So just before we dive into that, what's your definition of wokeism, and then why is it out?
So I did a little homework to make sure I was ready, I think, for this term, woke. So I went to Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Woke, definition of woke, is aware and actively attentive to important societal facts and issues. So I think
it's not often used in a positive way, though, is it?
right. So like, if you just think about that definition, I think it's a very positive intention to be woke, right? To be aware and attentive. Now, I think what it's turned into is a virtue signaling sort of tribalism of people, more about being right than actually trying to solve problems and bring awareness. And I think wokeism is sort of this, you know, in really great times when you have zero percent interest rates globally and money's free, great. In those nice times, people have more time and attention to put towards things, and that's great. But then they also have more time and attention to put towards things, and it becomes this like, I'm better than you, John, I'm better than you, Scott, because I have a belief. I don't think that's like the best intention for being woke. I think if you're going to be woke, like, it's actually about solving the problems with great intention for helping humanity. And so as I think about the world now, we have an active war going on. We have in America banks failing. We have people getting laid off. We have, you know, it feels like the big thing hasn't even happened yet. Like, we have multiple bubbles bursting. Consumer, you know, debt in this world is at an all-time high. You know, we have AI now potentially replacing, you know, millions and millions of jobs. It just seems like now in this, it's the world shifted, and instead of trying to be right, we should actually band together and try to just help each other out versus fight against each other. And I think this idea of wokeism is caused a lot of fighting across sides, especially in America and like liberal and conservative politics. It's become more of this like, again, I use this word virtue signaling. It's like, I just want to appear to look good. And that I don't think is something we want to propagate. I think generally to be aware and actively attentive to important societal facts and issues is a good thing. And that comes from a good place. And so I think in the future, when I said wokeism is out, I think people are just going to have less margin, less time, because we're going to have to solve some real problems. Again, clean energy, food production. Like, this is stuff we need to put our attention to. Like, this is actually going to kill us on the planet. You know, not being right about, you know, how we say things, you know, correcting each other. Like, I mean, I understand those points of view, and I get why it's important to respect groups and people and all of that. But we spend all of our time solving that, and then people are getting laid off from the AI bots, and we're going into mass hunger. We don't have food in the world. I mean, we're gonna go the way of the dinosaurs and sort of just go through extinction. So I just, that was my prediction, because I think we have some bigger stuff happening in the world to put our attention to.
Does it have to be a choice, though? Because I really like the point you're making in terms of us directing attention to solving real, you know, problems. But even in, and I also understand and have experienced what feels like virtue signaling. But in terms of a, you know, kind of a growth mindset approach, can we still pursue wanting to make sure that we're evolving in our sort of language and how we treat groups and you know, how we refer to people and sort of keep educating ourselves in those things that matter on an interpersonal scale while also potentially directing our attention to more, you know, larger scale issues, like you say, like staying on the planet kind of thing. Can it be both?
Scott, course. Like most things in life, it's not either or. It's like an and. And like, let's do both. I think what happens is like most things, the media actually propagates this more than what's actually real. So like the media makes this bigger issue, I think, than most people are. Like you said, I think most of us want everyone to feel a more inclusive environment. We want to have more involvement with diverse groups. We want all of that. But then that doesn't like sell headlines and clickbait. So what do? Media uses that as clickbait to rile up some anger. Anger and fear sell much better than Scott and I agreeing on something and having like a civilized discussion. So again, I think this is all about the media model right now. It's like media doesn't get paid unless they get clicks, and clicks are more fun. Clicks are acquired more with some damning headlines. So no, I think it is a world of and where we can become more inclusive, more consciousness. I'll keep going back to that word. Like, I think the idea of woke is actually being more conscious of our own behaviors and how we're affecting others around us. And I think, yes, I absolutely want the world to be more conscious, because again, if we have more conscious people developing conscious AI models, those AI models, those large language models will be more conscious and make more better conscious decisions. And I think actually this is going to be a whole new realm of study, is conscious AI. Is like, how are we, you know, especially in the realm of like, you know, you see it now happening, psychedelic research and the, you know, the effects of psilocybin on the human mind and how that opens up neural pathways that help people expand their ways of thinking and mindset. I mean, I think this is all going to be integrated. Like maybe people who are tripping on mushrooms, they're going to help train the AI models, and there's going to be a more conscious AI model and more elevated data point, right? So I think, again, it comes back to being present to today's society, what's happening, and just trying to listen more and less fighting, like just having open discussions about issues and not making people wrong for their beliefs. So in that case,
that'd be nice.
I'm all about that. I'm all about whatever that society is, and whatever, maybe we just need a rebranding, because maybe the word woke has now got some it's a little too politicized now, and maybe we need a just reasonable people who are reasonable and want to just the reasonable movement.
It doesn't sound like you can get a lot of clicks on that one, but I'm with you.
Yeah, exactly. No clicks.
So you have said, Alex, that with the hybrid work model and increasing expectations for profits also comes more monitoring and KPI ownership for employees. And companies that build software that can track productivity and measure KPIs precisely win over companies that aren't measuring performance at that granular level. Can you perhaps talk to us a little bit about how you're seeing this playing out in the relationship between people and organizations?
I think the sales organization in a company has been utilizing this system for a long time. It's a quota system, right? Sales reps measure their success on achieving quota. So if I'm a sales rep and I have $1 million quota and I achieve my $1 million quota, I'm likely getting my commission, I'm getting paid, and I'm, you know, promotions and all those things. You know, other parts of the organization, I think, have, you know, less measurable KPIs. And so in a world where profits are prioritized in a higher interest rate environment, I think more departments need to focus on their quota system, whatever that is for their department. For engineers, it's also, it can also be measured quite easily. It's how much code can you ship, right, in PRs and tickets and things like that. And is it quality code? Is it moving the needle? Is that code tied to a product that's making more marginal revenue for the company, right? So it's just, what is the quota for the department? I think as organizations before, at least in tech startup land, people get a little hiring frenzy when you get the venture capital. You think you need 10 layers of middle management and product management and all of this. And actually, you just need really two people in an organization. You need people who can sell product and build product. Everything else is sort of just extra support. And so as you think about building product and selling product, right, where do you fall in that paradigm? You do need other functions, obviously, like you need finance and you need back office and all of that. But that supports the end goal, which is, as a company, I'm selling something And then is the product great? I'm going to build it. So we really focus our hires on those two. Are you selling it more? Are you building it? And then what are the measurable KPIs as it pertains to building it or selling it that we want to measure as a company that we care about? Which really helps too with hybrid remote models. So we're sort of a hybrid. We have Chicago, Austin offices, but we also have people across the world and the US. And so it's really important in a hybrid model that you can measure success. So people don't feel like they have to log in to Slack and be online. They can work from anywhere, but they're hitting their quote unquote quota and they're free to live their lives and as they want. So that's sort of the cultural design we've been implementing, is making sure everyone knows what is their measurable success metric, and then they know how they're doing at the company.
As we kind of draw to a close, the final thing that I would like us to talk about, and it's a big question, so we'll probably only just scratch the surface of this, is we've touched on this notion that AI introduces a whole load of peril because it's uncertain, it's complex, we don't know where it's going, and there aren't maybe that many people really understand what it does and how it could work. So the moral component of leadership, and we saw this in the 2008 financial crisis, where you had people running organizations using products they didn't understand, and they didn't understand how they worked, and therefore they didn't know what decisions they were really making. What are the kind of moral implications for leaders today as we embark on this journey? What do they need to do to prevent, even bigger disasters happening like that in the future, where, AI might collapse a company, or it might destroy a marketplace, or it might do worse?
Yeah, I think we need to move from a checkers system to a chess system, and we need to think a little bit ahead. I think the world's been very reactive, and you can see that, like you said, it's sort of this promoted mindset of move fast and break things and disrupt, which is really great for, again, capitalism and profits and winning markets. But in a world where moving fast and breaking things implies we might be breaking the human model, which is, it's like, what are we optimizing? Are we optimizing for humans being on the planet? Are we optimizing to profits? Like, what is the outcome we want? Maybe we do need to actually think about slowing down as it pertains to thinking seven steps ahead of, well, if the AI replaces this labor category, what's going to happen in this market? And then, okay, if that happens, like what's going to happen? And like, let's think a little bit before we implement these technologies. Because again, GPT-4 just released and it's already like beating the SAT. Like it's already like, smarter on tests than us. What's GPT-8 going to be like? I mean, like, and they don't even know I think the scary thing is we don't even know how these neural network, large language model work. We don't know actually how they get to the answer, the output. And so at some point we're going to lose control. And is that good? Do we want to lose control? I think we need to answer these philosophical questions before you kind of move forward past this moment. Because it definitely feels like the internet came out publicly. Everyone's using the internet. That felt big. Mobile felt big. This feels bigger than all of it combined. This feels like everything we've been developing over the past 3 decades is all coming together, and it's awesome from just like a pure, like if you're been in the scene for a long time and like we can do this now, but just because we can do something doesn't mean that we necessarily need to deploy that at scale. Mm-hmm. It's like proving to ourselves that we can outbeat ourselves. Like maybe we're just good and we can like relax for a little bit and let this just like see through the system. So I think again, cautionary optimism, making sure we're thinking around the economic implications of these models. And if it is true that this will replace, 300 million, 500 million jobs, what do those people do? We talked about this, Scott. What do these people do? Mm-hmm. And let's answer that question before we move forward, maybe. I think that would be a really responsible way to think. Like, let's play chess. What do these people do? Oh, we're going to rescale them. Cool. How are we going to do that? How long is it going to take? And all those things. So exciting times, scary times, all the above. It's definitely fun to be in the arena and part of it and helping to at least help design some of it. But again, I think my responsibility is more consciousness to our decision-making, more responsibility, more humans integrated into the system, being a part of the solution, and helping form the strategy. So it's definitely going to be wild times ahead for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Alex, thank you. Thank you so much for kind of giving us the insight into what you're kind of worried about and concerned, because you know you're playing with fire in this industry, and you're obviously very aware of what you're doing and treading a line between, you know, the opportunity and the peril around it, which I can really acknowledge and see, you know, that you're incredibly conscious of that. And we would probably love to hear from you again in the future about, you know, how this is playing out from a leadership perspective, and maybe get Dan into the conversation as well, because I'm sure you have some super interesting conversations.
Yeah, we'd love to bring Dan. We could definitely all jam on this. We love thinking ahead about how this is going to play out in 10, 20 years.
Yeah, Alex, thank you so much. How can people get a hold of you or find you?
You can find me, well, LinkedIn's probably the network I use the most. So Alex Zekoff on LinkedIn, same on Twitter, same on Instagram too. So I do some landscape photography on the side. It was really great chatting with you all. Really interesting conversation, and looking forward to the next one.
Yeah. And for our listeners, until next time, remember, the world is evolving. Are you?